Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID and infectious disease. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I want to start with the newsiest item first. The USDA has just ordered a regime of testing samples of milk from dairy facilities around the country. They are starting in seven states, including California, and they are testing for bird flu, which has already been identified in a lot of dairies, principally by state-level officials. What practically does having a more nationalized testing regime accomplish by way of public health?
You and I have been talking about this off and on for a while now. That is, we haven't been aggressively trying to understand where this virus is and how it's being transmitted and how people are getting it and if people are transmitting it person to person. We just haven't been doing enough of the real legwork that needs to be done. So this, I think, is a move in the right direction. I think it's late. I think we should have been doing this a long time ago, but the USDA has a conflicted mandate, and I think it's moved much too slowly. So I think this, Brian, will help. It'll give us a better idea in those states whether how much of the flu, this particular flu strain, is in milk products. We know it's there. We saw, what, a week or so ago, the reports of H5N1 in raw milk. So we know that that's a problem, but we don't know how extensive it is.
On this note, we had a question come in from a listener through our inbox. Karen in Petaluma asks, what do we know about the usefulness of masks in preventing infection with influenza?
We would have to primarily extrapolate from our experience with COVID, and that is that N95 and KN95 masks do work very well against SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID. We know that they work very well against other airborne pathogens. They work even better against pathogens that are passed by droplets that are come out from people's mouths or nose and go about maybe 6 feet. So I think we can say comfortably that masks will protect the user against getting infected with H5N1 or all influenza strains, and that they will effectively prevent the user from spreading influenza to other people.
You say we're extrapolating from what we learned about COVID. It took a very long time into the COVID pandemic for public health authorities to confirm that it was airborne and acknowledge that masks could play some role in preventing its spread. I can remember when all the public health advice about influenza kind of presumed spread by droplets and made recommendations about washing your hands with great frequency when you were out in public. Has there been new research showing the spread of influenza includes airborne transmission, or are we just assuming we made the same mistake in understanding that disease?
Well, I should say that you make a very good point. I said extrapolate. We certainly had data before that masks worked against influenza, but I think what we learned and what you just pointed out is that the data that we had, the real solid basic science that we had to demonstrate efficacy of masks against airborne and droplet, was not as deep as any of us thought. When we looked back, it was more there was a lot more assumption than there was strong science. The science that we had clearly suggested protection, but it was not as strong or as deep as we would have liked. And that was really a disastrous, as you pointed out, with COVID, because we, and I include myself in this, very early in the pandemic, assumed that SARS-CoV-2 would transmit just like influenza, that is primarily droplets, but some airborne. And what we learned pretty quickly, not quickly enough though, was that SARS-CoV-2 was primarily an airborne virus with some droplet transmission as well. So that was, well, ever since then, 4 years ago, now going on 5 years ago, we've really put a lot of effort into understanding better the transmission of not just SARS-CoV-2, but also influenza and other respiratory-borne viruses like tuberculosis and measles, just exactly how they are transmitted. So I think we have much more knowledge today than we certainly had 4 or 5 years ago.
I want to go through one piece of research that hit my radar, a new study out of Singapore published in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases. Singapore, like a lot of other wealthy countries that aren't the United States, has a national health system, one of the byproducts of which is they have a much more robust data set for studying how diseases behave in a population. And these researchers set out to ask the question and answer the question, do the retooled vaccines, the bivalent vaccines meant to target newer strains of COVID in the Omicron lineage, meaningfully change the likelihood of getting long COVID after an infection? And they mined a whole ton of records, tried to create two comparison groups of people who had been boosted with the original vaccine and people who had been boosted with the bivalent vaccine. Looked at their medical records up to a year out from being infected and found a 38% reduction in post-acute sequelae, which I think we could just shorthand as things that might be called long COVID, in people who'd gotten the bivalent vaccine, which seemed to me like a pretty meaningful difference and a strong case for keeping current with the newest versions of the vaccine. How solid is the research?
I think the study was good. And it's consistent with what we've been seeing previously. That is, people who are vaccinated, not necessarily even up to date, but especially those up to date with vaccines, if they get COVID, they have a reduced risk, a substantially reduced risk of developing long COVID. And the Singapore study really just adds more evidence in this regard. Essentially, right now coming to mind, I can't think of any studies that have not shown vaccine efficacy in terms of preventing long COVID. So I completely agree with you, Brian. This is a very big argument for people to be vaccinated and to be up to date with their vaccines.
So this is a relative reduction in risk of long COVID from being vaccinated with the original vaccine to being vaccinated with the more recent booster. How much do we think the absolute reduction in risk is? Like how much benefit are you getting from just being vaccinated at all?
That's a tougher question to answer. Almost all the studies we have are relative reductions in the risk of getting disease. So long COVID, excuse me. So if we say that 7% of people get long COVID, and that's a very conservative number, I think a lot of data suggests the number is higher. But if 7% of people get it, that may mean an absolute reduction that could be not, it won't sound as dramatic, but it still represents an awful lot of people. Given 7% of the population that's had COVID or repeatedly had COVID, you have a very large number. So any percentage reduction, any relative reduction, is going to represent a large swath of people who won't get long COVID.
All right, Dr. Swartzberg, before we end this abbreviated Fund Drive edition of Corona Calls, I wanted to move on from the news you can actually use to the political news on COVID. Since we spoke last week, the House Select Committee on the Coronavirus Pandemic has released its more than 500-page report. This is a Republican-run subcommittee. And the significant conclusions of the report, many seemed to just kind of confirmed the political priors of the people who authored it, but I thought we could run through them. The committee came down on the side of the lab leak theory that COVID did not come out of the wild, but out of a biosafety research facility in Wuhan, China. It came out critical of some public health measures like distancing and masking, which proved very unpopular in red state America. It did praise a couple that Donald Trump had some direct responsibility for. It praised the Trump administration's travel restrictions and also Operation Warp Speed, the program that accelerated vaccine development, and had some proposals for moving forward, mostly relating to firming up the supply chain for both personal protective equipment like masks and drugs and drug precursors, so that the United States is not exclusively reliant on foreign trade for responding to a pandemic. I guess I wanted to get your big picture take. Was there anything new, interesting, or revelatory in the committee's findings?
The simple answer is no. My take on it was that it just made me very, very sad when I read that. It made me sad because the question as to where SARS-CoV-2 originated, how it got into the human population, is a terribly important one. It's a real basic question that we need to try to do our best to answer. And the reason it made me so sad was because it's a completely politicized issue. And we're not going to get truth when something is politicized like this. And so when I saw this report and I read it, I just groaned. I just thought, please, this is not a question for politics. This is a question for science. And this is a question for making fundamental public health policy for the next pandemic. And to politicize it like this does nothing but make it more difficult. It's interesting when you look at the report, there was the report from the committee. As you pointed out, the majority was were Republicans. And the minority report, all the Democrats had their own report that essentially attacked a lot of what the Republicans' report said. So we have politicians fighting over what should be issues that need to be answered by understanding nature, and that is by using our scientific tools to do that. So that's why it made me so sad. Yes, I agree with parts of the report. Project Warp Speed was an outstanding accomplishment that saved an awful lot of lives and an awful lot of people getting very sick and an awful lot of people getting long COVID. So that is the development of the vaccine so quickly. So that was a fabulous accomplishment, and somewhat ironic that Trump never made much out of that when he was the president. As a matter of fact, when I remember when he and his wife got vaccinated, they did it surreptitiously and didn't divulge that they got vaccinated for a while. It's very odd.
You know, he did kind of brag about it early on the campaign trail in this presidential election cycle, but he kept kind of getting silence and occasional boos from his own crowds when he tried to brag about the rapid development of COVID vaccine and apparently recalibrated his politics because now he wants Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head Health and Human Services.
Right. Going on with that report, the supply chain issue is a very important issue. We can all remember how our healthcare workers, particularly those doctors and nurses in the emergency rooms, were reusing masks over and over and over again, didn't have adequate other personal protective equipment. It was a horrible problem, and that needs to be fixed. So there are some points made in the report that were valid, that had nothing to do with the origin of SARS-CoV-2, of course, but they were valid points. I think in terms of the question about where the virus came from, I'm not sure that we're ever going to get an answer. We certainly have to continue to work on that, but I'm not sure there's ever going to be a true smoking gun. If one looks at the evidence for a lab leak theory, it's pretty thin, but it remains a reasonable hypothesis to explore. The preponderance of evidence that I have seen, good evidence, strongly suggests that the virus came from nature. That is, it came from bats, probably to an intermediate host yet to be identified, or hosts, and then spread to human beings, just like its cousin SARS-CoV-1, the virus that caused the outbreak in 2002. So that's the best we know right now. It's probably from nature. Most certainly, if it is, it's from bats. The lab leak theory remains a hypothesis that needs to be pursued, but the evidence for that is much slimmer.
If I'm not mistaken, it took close to a decade to definitively confirm the origins of SARS-CoV-1.
That's right. That's right. It's not an easy job to retrospectively go back and look.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for spending another Monday with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.